B-Pod Studios.
Today on Talkin' Rock with Meltdown.
There's lots to get to today with Johannes from Avatar as their new record Hunter Gatherer is out. We talk about the album in detail, plus talk about Corey Taylor and his contribution to the album.
He mentioned that he was open to it if we were interested, which was a very nice and kind thing of him to offer.
Speaking of Corey Taylor, just like CMFT, Johannes is a big wrestling fan. We had to get into some wrestling talk, and this time around I asked him the same question I asked Corey. Who are some of the best workers of the microphone in the world of wrestling?
Steve Austin's there. Not there are many.
We talk about working with Jay Rustin again, how the band has evolved, about putting the makeup on, and maybe his dual personality, and a ton more today.
That is a big question.
And lots more today with Johannes Eckerstrom from Avatar on Talkin' Rock.
This is Talkin' Rock. Talkin' Rock. Your backstage pass to some of your favorite rock artists. Here's your host, Meltdown.
Hey, thanks as always for checking out the Talkin' Rock with Meltdown podcast. I do appreciate it. I have to be honest with you. It's one of those things with Avatar that I just love this band so much. I saw them live a couple years ago. I want to say maybe 3 years ago. And it's like watching hockey or NASCAR. You have to see it live to really appreciate what they're doing. I've been to some festivals and different things, and I never really, you know, paid much attention to them. Then I saw them live in a club with about 1,000 people, and I was, like, blown away. And then I started digging into the band a little bit, and it really became apparent that I really liked this band. So this is one of those interviews where I actually, instead of being contacted by a PR person or a record company, I actually reached out to them and said, hey, can I talk to Johannes? I want to talk to him and, you know, talk about this new record, Hunter Gatherer, which I just got on vinyl just last week. It's killer if you get a chance to check it out. I mean, just that opening single, Colossus and Silence of the Age of Apes and all this other stuff is just so great. So if you get a chance, go out and snag it. In the meantime, let's just talk about this new record, talk about wrestling, talk about his use of makeup, just tons of stuff today. It's Johannes from Avatar, one of my favorites today on Talkin' Rock.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah,
how are you?
I'm doing great. The new record is out. I just got my vinyl copy the other day. I've been listening to it all week, man. I'll tell you what, I'm just going to start this off by saying that I really got into you guys when I saw you guys live. And I think that it's like one of those things where when you explain hockey or racing or something to somebody, or even wrestling for that matter, like, you know, I know you're a fan, that you have to see it live to kind of understand it. And I guess I never really understood Avatar until about 3 years ago, I think. I saw you guys live here in Detroit at St. Andrews Hall, which is a small venue of about 1,000 people. And I was, like, blown away by how good the live show is. So I guess my first question is, when making this new record and stuff, how much of it do you think about the live performance aspect of it when writing the new songs?
Very little in a literal sense. You know, like, we don't have this. Oh, we should write it like this because this is the kind of breakdown that people could do a wall of death or whatever. You know, like, there's not a calculated way of thinking about how things will be live. It's just, to the extent we think live is, we write music that moves us, and we presume that it will move someone else just because of it, just because, you know, as it moved us. And then we make sure to have a foundation of a song. You know, we might have samples, synthesizers, whatever, you know, somewhere in there. But the essentials of the song are always something that is performed by the five-piece orchestra Avatar, you know, which means that the fundamentals of the song, no matter how much fun we end up having in the studio, is something that we can recreate live, and that the core energy of the song lies within the five of us playing in a room together. So to that extent, yes, we think about live, but not in a writing thing. Just there's an exception. The song Justice on the new album. Mm. There's always that thing where, you know, when Jonas or Tim comes with a new riff and shows us, and one way for me to measure quality is just like, again, if it moves me, and one way I sense that is, do I get a specific vision from it? And the best example that I've been telling a million times is for Hail the Apocalypse. You know, like I saw a doomsday prophet on the days the bombs were falling. You know, like this kind of, the story was within inside of the riff. But with Justice, the riffs, when I heard them, I saw that, I saw the mosh pits. I saw a big festival stage, the sun is still up, and, you know, it, and there's a pit going on. And I usually don't see that first when we deal with songs. But with Justice, I did.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that because, you know, it's like, as far as that's concerned, I guess my next question is, I mean, now that the record's out and stuff, and God only knows when you're going to be able to go do it live, but has this record been done for a while, or when did you guys finish it up?
Yeah, well, we recorded it in December and a bit in January, and mixing throughout February, and I want to say that the master was delivered in March. It must have been. Suddenly, for whatever reason, this year is a bit of a blur.
Yeah.
I don't know if you heard, but yeah, there's a pandemic going on.
I have heard.
It kind of messes with the timeline. But I guess in March, like before, I think it was before Hell Broke Loose, you know?
Yeah.
And the original intent was to release it in May. That was always the plan, give or take a little, depending on if we would hit our deadlines and do the music videos on time and all that. Then we happened to do three shows in Russia together with the Swedish band Friends of Our Sabaton. And we were probably among the very last musicians standing on a stage in at least all of Europe. Mm. And probably that's probably true for, you know, the States as well. Like we were among the last ones before things started to lock down there, and we in those days we were realized as we were there, like, oh boy, this is actually happening. Like my wife would call me, like, there's no more toilet paper in the store. Like yeah. There was like that whole thing spread over here, but here it was even more stupid because those our rolls are made domestically. I digress. So we would talk there, like, okay, so what do we do? Like, we might not tour in a while. And we asked the question, because it would have been malpractice not to ask the question, would it be smarter to wait until we can tour to release the album? And as was maybe, but no, because this album represents us now, where we're at now artistically.
Right.
And on top of that, we have been very open with the fact that, hey, we're entering the studio. Hey, we are mixing. Hey, it's done. You know, like we shared that with our fans this time. So it would have felt very dishonest and unfair to. And now you got to wait because we want to optimize the promotion for an upcoming tour. You just can't do that. But we had to push it a little bit into August anyway, because it was, you know, when you pull the trigger, you need to, the grown-ups at the office, they need their minimum 6 weeks to make a release happen, you know? And it was time to pull the trigger was when I think we were all the least sure about what is things going to be like now for the foreseeable future. So we had to wait a little bit. And as we waited a little bit, it was like, oh, okay, then it has to come out in August. So it was just out of necessity.
Now, you say that you guys were originally going to release it in May. Is that why you guys decided to like end the Avatar Country era of Avatar in May?
Yeah, it was going to float into each other particularly nicely.
Yeah.
You know, now it was, but that was, again, more of a market strategy. So, you know, that you can play around with anyway. So we just had it a bit more spread out. But otherwise, we wanted to still, even though people were anticipating something was coming up, we wanted to do this, boom, by Avatar Country, and then boom, here's the new thing, and boom, boom, two music videos in a pretty short period. It's just that another thing that happened was that, so we filmed all the footage for both Silence and Age of Apes and Colossus before going to Russia. So again, pre-COVID. It's just that then we start to see some footage from it. Like he started to edit stuff and sent it to us so we could see some stuff while we were away. And Silence in Age of Apes, it just wasn't good. Like the performance part, us playing together, that was really good. Mm-hmm. But then we had a story we were telling, ironically, about a pandemic and how people reacted to it. But just unfortunately, it became evident during editing that the script didn't hold water. It wasn't good enough of an idea. But in that kind of way where you wouldn't see it on paper, you would just see it when seeing the end result.
Right.
So then we had to start invent, you know, come up with a new music video. Yeah, we have us playing, but what else is going to happen? And what is going to happen that we can do with me living in Helsinki in Finland and the rest of the band in Sweden? So but that is still a kind of cool thing that we, you know, are forced to work creatively within, you know, a more narrow framework than you're used to. Because that kind of pushes your creativity in a way, and it becomes almost fun to play around with. And that's why I'm in these Polaroid pictures in that music video. Mm. Yeah. Colossus had the other problem the other way around. The story part was excellent, but the performance part didn't hold water in that one.
Yeah.
So there we, hence the holograms.
Yeah, that is kick-ass, yeah. And it's funny how you mentioned that, you know, during these crazy times, you have to get a little bit more creative. So how have you guys tried to reach out to the fans? Obviously, you dropped a record, but I mean, and you got videos and different things like that. But that kind of stuff you've always done. So in this kind of crazy time here in COVID, what kind of other things are you doing to reach out to the Avatar fans?
Well, we have avatarcountry.com, which I guess translates to be a fan club. Of sorts. And there we start to come up with more material to upload, Q&As and stuff. Some of them after we've done them live for the Avatar Country citizens, we have put them on YouTube, I think, a bunch of them. Mm-hmm. So we've done different Q&As, like just us with the band sitting answering questions. But we also had, I was kind of hosting Jay Rustin there. And also Yuan and Emma, who Yuan Kalian, of course, photographer, director, and director of photography when we do music videos, write the scripts 9 times out of 10 and all that, you know, our video guy. And Emma Falkensjö is doing our makeup and hair and is also always end up doing much more. So they are our little music video team. So I did Q&As with them. They're finally starting to do more playthroughs and instructional videos on how to play certain songs of ours. So, yeah, we have become a bit more social media savvy, which we probably should have become earlier anyway. So that's a positive that this whole thing has brought to us in our band. I realize I'm in a privileged position that I can say that has brought any kind of positives. Like, again, I'm me and those people around me that I care about the most are all healthy today. So, and knock on wood on that.
Yeah, that's right. You know, it's so funny you just mentioned that you're in this position because 20 years ago would have been a whole different story as far as like reaching out to the fans and you know, but with the internet and all the technology and stuff we have nowadays, I could just imagine some of the questions, too, that you probably had to deal with. How many times did somebody ask you, when are you going to play our city? Name the city. are you coming to Vegas?
You know, a lot. But it's also, you know, it's mainly, like, I think it's a bit from all over the place. And usually it is phrased in the form of, you know, we look forward to you coming to, or we hope you're coming, which is slightly different. But then, yeah, you have those. Will you ever come to? But when they say Colombia or Singapore, it's a way more valid question than Vegas, you know, like. Vegas, or Detroit, whatever. You're like, yeah, we have the address saved from last time. We are coming back, you know.
Yeah.
But then when people in countries we've never been to us, it's like, yeah, we are always trying to get to go to those places we haven't been to yet. And the first time is always the hardest. Like last year, it was finally we kicked that door in with Mexico. We played a major festival there. And the reaction, the response, and the hands we shook makes us feel very confident in like, yeah, we will be able to return now. But that first visit is tricky.
Yeah, it's breaking down the door the first time. You just mentioned festivals, and of course, I think that's probably where I discovered you guys first, at Rock on the Range, when they were doing Rock on the Range in Columbus. Talk about playing the festivals. How much fun are those?
They are fun. They are, depends on the festival.
Yeah.
Depends a lot of festival. Well, one thing is, of course, that is where you are, if you're our type of band, you know, that is where we usually get to see the biggest crowds, and that's something special in itself. You know, you have that nice little new profile picture of you from behind in front of a lot of people.
Yeah, right.
You know, you got that kick, and then depending on, you know, if you're really lucky, you happen to be on the same day as some other band you know, and with that big headliner that you've never seen or you're a huge fan of. I particularly remember we played the festival name now escapes me, but it was System of a Down were headlining, and it was just the other year.
Was that the one in Las Vegas?
No, it wasn't Vegas. I want to say Chicago, maybe.
Okay, like really the open air fest or something.
Yeah. And yeah, it was inside a stadium. And I've seen them before. I've seen them in Sweden, and they, you know, they're popular all over.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that but we got to stand at the soundboard because we are huge, huge fans. And I think in particular, Mesmerize came out right in a period where we were really getting into writing music and gearing that up as teenagers. And that really did a lot for us. I think gave a lot of inspiration of how you can put different things together. And to hear them, and there's always something with seeing any band in that band's respective home country, and just how people are singing along the whole arena, and to see a band like that do a show of that size, because they are, yeah, they're big and sweet, you know, but maybe not Metallica big or whatever.
Right.
But to hear those songs that we listen to in our little gang be sung by that legion of people, you know, like, That is something that was a bonus experience on that festival, for instance. So festivals are fun.
So I like to ask bands from outside the United States, and you guys are definitely qualified for that. But growing up in Sweden and whatnot, what does success in the United States mean to a band like you guys?
It means a lot, of course. Like it's the country where all the movies are made in, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Just the culture and the pop culture, maybe specifically I grew up with, it's been very American centric. Of course, it's that big land in the West. So it meant a lot from that sense. Then of course in Sweden in particular, and the bands we grew up listening to, the big one was always that we kind of dreamt of was Japan.
Mm.
Because In Flames, The Haunted, everyone did Back to Deep Purple did a live album in Japan.
Yeah.
Ozzy did it live at the Budokan. Everybody did a live at the Budokan, you know, like, so, and it's even that, you know, Tom Waits, big in Japan.
Yeah.
Thing. But no, but that being said, it definitely had its place, and you could definitely tell on how it also impressed people back home. It's actually, what's so fun is this a big Friday evening talk show in Sweden and we have this pop star, I don't know if she qualifies as a pop star anymore, but she's really good. Her name is Robin with a Y.
Mm-hmm.
She had some success in the States at some point. She talked about, because then what happens is like back in Sweden, is that you get a little bit of success in the States, and people are so impressed by that, that you immediately become more popular at home. It's kind of, it's a little, what do you call it? Like whatever those things that Boy Scouts get when they have done an achievement.
Mm, yeah.
It's a feather in the hat, I should say. Maybe.
Right, right, right. Yeah, a merit badge.
There you go.
Yeah.
Thank you. Sometimes I forget how to English.
Well, you know what? English is my first language. You already speak better than I do. So, hey, with making this record, correct me if I'm wrong. Did you guys record this onto tape?
That is correct.
Yeah. So Jay Rustin is a friend of mine, right? And I know you were just talking about working with Jay. And Jay just texted me. He says, ask him about our romantic boat rides in Helsinki every day to the recording studio.
Yeah. No, yeah. So we did the vocals in Helsinki. We did everything else in the States, in Los Angeles, in
right.
Sphere Studios, which was great. And then we finished up the vocals here where I live. So I got to be a bit closer to home for that one. So it was most of the time was just he and I, and then John joined us for the last couple of days, just, you know, because he wanted to. And this is a really cool studio, actually. Like, you have this old fortress, Suomenlinna, right outside of the, you know, on an island right outside the center of Helsinki. That was, you know, it was built when Finland was still part of Sweden. Then it fell to the Russians. And, you know, now it's of course Finnish. And it has been part of all these different wars. It has been a prison island, fortress, obviously. As a Swede, I'm bitterly reminded of history when you walk around there. The cannons are facing west. When it was built, they were facing east. Mm. But then, it ended up being on a different side of the border. And there's a nice little studio out there. And they mostly do like hip hop and electronica and stuff like that. But actually, Elvis Costello was there after we were, which was funny, but it's great for vocals, close to home, and yeah, you have a little ferry ride every morning in the winter landscape. And I was looking forward, I was going to show him the town and restaurants and having home for dinner, but we worked so much. It's just as a producer, like, he has that good way of, like, it was obvious because I was in the control room in the States, you know, so I would hear him say, yeah, they effed up that take, and then hit it to the microphone. Mm-hmm. So, guys, that was really, really great. Now, however, if you would like to, you know, that part, knowing that, and knowing I wanted to push myself as far as possible, and he knew that, which means that, you know, microphone on. Hey, Johannes, that was really, really great. I'm like, okay, but we're doing it again. Don't worry about it. And we did that for a lot of hours. So I didn't get to show him as much as we didn't get to go on all the romantic dates to accommodate those ferry rides that I was hoping for.
And he also said on a day off, I guess, in Hollywood, he said between recording tracks, you walked like 20 miles.
Yeah, like I took that park. They have that observatory.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, where they shot Rebel Without a Cause, that scene early on in the film. So I took an Uber there, you know, hiked up to that. And then, like, yeah, I guess I'm going to walk for a bit more. And then I want to hit an Uber into the center and, you know, take a selfie in front of places. But I never took that Uber. So I walked from that observatory in all the way to... what is it called? The Rainbow Bar and Grill.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And yeah, it turns out it was a 5-hour walk.
So when you walk into the Rainbow Bar and Grill, do people know who you are?
It wasn't open when I came.
Oh, okay.
So I took that selfie and moved on with life. Got back to the center and, you know, but, you know, get to just be a tourist for a day. I think I really went outside twice in our whole stay there. Two times that really mattered, and otherwise, yeah, went to a cafe a couple of times for breakfast. But that was really it. We were so focused on what we were doing, and then, you know, sometimes we take turns hitting a wall, or hopefully, ideally, we take turns. Because then it's like, guys, I need to go. I just need to go. So it was, I don't know, monotonous. Do something physical, yet monotonous is a very good, heals the brain.
Yeah.
And, keep your legs moving. For 5 hours, yeah, that rebooted their brain. It was fun to be in a band again after that, so it helped.
So Corey Taylor, obviously Jay's worked with Corey on a bunch of stuff, and he gets Corey to come to the studio, and Corey's wife is a big fan of your guys' band and stuff. And so while he's there, you decide, let's put him to work. Is that what happened?
Well, he when he asked if he could come by, you know, and that question went through Jay, he also offered like that he mentioned that he was open to it if we were interested, which was a very nice and kind thing of him to offer. So he shows up, and kind of going through the head, okay, so this dude that are, he's in all of these bands that we've been growing up listening to, a really cool guy that took us on tour, and you could argue one of those voices of a generation, mm-hmm. speaking of System of a Down, you know, that whole era for us growing up, like Slipknot was also one of those bands that came and changed the game for us. And yes, I did play a cover with friends in high school of Duality, you know? So it's that. And what do you do when you have a guy like that to enter the studio? Well, you ask him to whistle. And it's really, well, the thing is, first we gave, I was just going through our songs in my head thinking, well, there's nothing here that was written as a duet, you know, there's nothing lyrically or musically that motivates a different voice for real, you know? So, but, and it was just also this brief, hey, let me listen to some songs and we hang out, drink coffee and talk, you know, like do that for a bit. So it wasn't really a room for that deepened collaboration in that sense. So yeah, so having some fun with some backup vocals, doing some gang vocal things together, and then, of course, the whistling. And that was very much inspired by the early South Park episodes when, yeah, George Clooney is there, but he's a dog, and Jay Leno is the cat. And I think Seinfeld was a turkey number two or number four or something like that. So with that kind of logic, it made perfect sense. Again, going back to the voice of a generation. And he was, you know, up for it, and he did a great job. His whistling on the album is better than my whistling on the demo, so... it was a win all around.
And that's for the song A Secret Door, if I'm not mistaken, or is it God of Secret?
Yeah, A Secret Door.
Okay, okay. Yeah, I've listened to the record about four or five times. I'm still learning it, so go ahead.
Oh, yeah, no, you're fine. No, but I just want to put credit where credit is due as well, because when we went to the studio, we are usually pretty much know where everything will go in all songs. But then there's always those outliers where you know, we really like what we have, but we feel we don't have everything. And Wormhole was, I would say, 85% done. And we loved those 85%, but we couldn't make it all fit together so to feel 100%. So as he came, and he's a songwriter, so we kind of, hey, here's an MP3. If anything comes to mind, let us know. And the next morning, he hummed a little melody with some root notes, basically like as a voice message to Jay going pretty much. And from that, we did a little jam in the band and were able to finish Wormhole. So he's a proper he co-wrote that with us in that way. And so the whistling was great. Doing some backup vocals was a lot of fun, but there is truly, I think, I'm very, very happy we got to put that song on the album and with that end result. So there, credit where credit is due.
Now, you talk about how, like, there's no duets and different things like that. But, you know, as with most of your records, your vocal parts take about four or five different turns. You know, that you use your vocal range. I mean, it's from the soft stuff from a Gun to heavy stuff from Colossus and every kind of thing in between. So it's like, even though there was no duet parts, your voice and your vocal stylings are all over the place on your records, aren't they?
Yeah, so maybe I was just selfish and didn't want to share. no, yeah, but it's also, I think it has ended up being like that. And I think it's connected to just that we have a very wide definition, I think, of what metal is to us and what kind of metal we play. You know, we are, for instance, we are huge death metal fans that don't really play death metal, but growing up and becoming a band and learning how to be a band, that was kind of what we played while learning. It was, you know, we covered Hammer Smashed Face, we covered Raining Blood, we covered stuff like that, you know. And so the roots are in that, but we also all became kind of metalhead through things that was before our time. So we are have a very much a love for what would be considered old school overall, and also an old school approach to what we do. And while at the same time, like, we embrace the stuff that came out as we were coming up as well, you know. So it's this, we are a bit all over the place, which I think is kind of common in our generation.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and just having that wide interest mean that we started to fill up our toolboxes early on with a lot of different influences and approaches, you know, from extreme stuff, which motivates the growling and the screaming, to the more melodic stuff, which motivates that. And then for a long time, I struggled. Now I have found ways to sing with a fairly high pitch, you know, with a bit of a range. But my natural voice, I guess, would be considered baritone. And as that, you know, I also had to find for a while role models elsewhere than the Halfords of this world. So, you know, oh, Peter Steele exists. Okay, you can do metal and have a deep voice. So
yeah,
there's a bit of that as well. And I love Tom Waits. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's like, yeah, some
stuff.
Great influences right there. So you and Corey get together, and I'm sure you guys probably talked about wrestling. So I'll ask you a question I just asked Corey just the other day, just a couple days ago. Who are the greatest wrestlers for working the mic?
Okay, there are a question of different styles and eras here. I would need to add, we need to put managers there as well.
For sure. Yep. Yeah,
so,
for sure.
You know, so you have a Bobby Heenan.
Yeah.
And you have a Jim Cornette, for instance.
Yeah.
For that. But then, of course, in pure wrestlers, the Ric Flair promos, you can see like the pop culture revival he has seen in the last couple of years kind of confirms this now, and that 30 for 30 that came out.
Yeah, that was great.
About him, and you see all those football teams and everything. Two claps and a Ric Flair. Clap, clap. Woo. And, you know, so he's on there. Macho Man Randy Savage.
Yes.
It's up really high. Like, of course, he was a cartoon character of that era. But, you know, when he was feuding with Hulk Hogan and how he hated him and how he put it across, and then, of course, the gossip is that he hated him for real, a huge chunk of their careers. So that, I guess, helped. But he was able to put that across and also the cream of the crop, Space is the Place, and To Sweet to Be Sour, Man of the Hour, you know, like all that.
Yeah.
And a cup of coffee in the big time, all these things. So he's there. Steve Austin's there. Not there are many.
You got to talk about The Rock, right? I mean, you have to, right? I mean, The Rock set the standard really high. Chris Jericho, guys like that.
Oh, Chris Jericho for sure. Yeah. Chris Jericho for sure. I love what The Rock do. His strength was he was amazing at his catchphrases.
Yes.
And his attitude and just being so charismatic, being a guy we wanted to be, I guess. We all kind of want to look like him in one way, to one extent or another, you know. But that is great. But I think most of it was, again, that he could do the it doesn't matter what your name is and those things, where maybe, you know, a Chris Jericho was more dynamic, or even, you know, if you talk that era, a Steve Austin, for instance, or a Mick Foley had, you know, were more dynamic as promos, I would say. And The Rock did something to me that was more specific, more niche, but he just did it better than anyone else.
Yeah, the article I saw that they had the American Dream as the top
person.
Oh,
there you go. Of course. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Hard times. Yes.
Yeah, so that was I brought that up to Corey, and like, you know, you could talk with Corey and you about wrestling, I guess, for hours. Then, you know, it's like but you know, I mean, it's like, you know, listen, you're up on stage doing your thing, like they're up on stage doing their thing. So there's some similarities there.
I take huge influence from that world, actually, because I grew up watching it and all that, so, and alongside with discovering metal and everything. And there are really so. one big thing is if you are interested in those kind of things that are done on stage, that are done in front of a live audience, I feel like there are more interviews with pro wrestlers and former pro wrestlers talking about their craft than you find with musicians, that you find with people who were in bands.
Mm.
They don't, which means there were more things I could learn more from what they were saying, not just studying what they were doing as they were doing it. And yeah, there is a certain, the art of, and here's, I guess, Ric Flair, where I also take influence of how they, of wrestling matches, not just the promos, is, you know, when Ric Flair and Ricky Steamboat would wrestle for an hour as the main event. So the audience has already been through a lot. And knowing that to take control over the emotions of your crowd, and that craft of figuring out where are they at right now.
Mm.
I need to bring them down and a bit sideways and into this pocket where I need them so they can go on this journey and you know, participate in the story I want to tell. That is something that I think pro wrestlers do better than the master of that craft do it better than anyone else, I guess. I guess there are certain stand-up comedians and stuff like that, you know, a Dave Chappelle, and especially now the stuff he put out in more, you know, the more recent ones on Netflix, where he really takes us on that journey and, you know, ties that pretty little knot on the whole thing at the end. You know, that craft of just taking us in and just twisting and turning us the way they see fit. I'm a very ambitious student of that game, and so I'm super fascinated when that happens in other live performing arts than just music. Of course, I get the most from music because that's what I do. But pro wrestling and comedians and even magicians and stuff, just anything that is presented on stage, that also is dependent on the reaction of the audience, as opposed to acting, to theater. It's theater, you do your thing. But with pro wrestling, you come in with a plan, and then you improvise, then you react, then you change the plan accordingly.
Yeah.
And a metal show is very much like that as well.
It's the psychology of it all.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I'll tell you what, two more things here, and we'll cut you loose. You've been more than generous with your time here. Speaking of the performance and stuff, talk about the transition that you make when you put your makeup on. Now, of course, you know, some have come before you at the Alice Coopers and different things like that. But when you put your makeup on and get ready to go on the stage, do you feel a transformation from Johannes to now all of a sudden like the lead singer of Avatar? Is there anything psychological when you don your makeup?
I feel that I am becoming myself more than that I'm becoming someone else. And then it's kind of weird to put your finger on it, but because I am not someone else now either, you know. But I don't know, if you dress up for disco on a Saturday or visit Graham on a Sunday, both are true, valid, real sides of you, I guess, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's something like that, but as the music is very much, it's come straight from our hearts, you know, it's us pouring out our souls in music and lyrics, and everything we do visually is meant to just answer the question, what does the music look like? And therefore it's this extension, this feedback loop of something that was within me to begin with. So yeah, there's a transformation that happens, maybe even more just a refocus. You kind of tune up the instrument in a way. So, and there is something ritualistic about it, but it's not, you know, that's a different, like Alice Cooper's The Man, you know, but that's a stage name. And I think that's the difference. He definitely played a character. And yeah, I do express myself in a theatrical way, but it's still, for better or worse, that's all me, you know, and that is a big, that I think is the big difference in what we do. That being said, yeah, that is obviously one of the people I've taken a lot of inspiration from.
I think I remember interviewing Marilyn Manson one time, and he told me that, you know, Alice Cooper and guys like that, they're playing a stage character, whereas himself, he is Marilyn Manson, you know? It's like makeup or not, that's how he is. So that's at least what he said.
All right, Brian.
Yeah, right, exactly. Hey, final thing here for you. With the new record, of course, a Hunter Gatherer out right now. Tell me about how the band has evolved over the years.
Oh, that is a big question. Well, I think evolving is, anyway, just that's the point. We chose to never, because, where do I even begin? Sorry.
You're fine.
There is a core idea. There's that core of Black Sabbath and the Beatles and that way of thinking. But other than that, it's very much very open where we go. The only thing that truly matters to us is that we don't go somewhere where we have been before. I mean, that being said, it's always going to be metal, and it's always going to be us doing that metal. So it's bound to sound like Avatar, whatever we end up doing. And I think that kind of proves between Avatar Country and Hunter Gatherer, I think those are two albums that somehow unmistakably sound like Avatar. Although one is a crazy-ass comedy album based on an inside joke and over-the-top tribute to any type of metal that has anything to do with slaying dragons and wielding swords. And then we go straight back to Earth, deal with, you know, our inner darkness, and the music becomes the vessel for that thing, you know, instead. Trying to take a good look at humanity and at ourselves. And still somehow both things are 100% Avatar. And one of the reasons we do all these, you know, that the pendulum swings so widely in our case is that we always look for some way of making the process hard for ourselves. There has to be some kind of unknown territory for ourselves. Some, you know, that's what's the prime motivator behind doing comedy or behind doing a concept album and, you know, write the book or to record live for the first time in the studio. And in this case, to just let's write way more songs than we're going to use. We had never done it like that before. So just to find some way of making it tough, a bit of a, always start to bite off more than you can chew, because that is kind of the secret in why in many cases, not all cases, but many, we tend to be particularly in love with a band's earlier half of their catalog. You know, there's that magic of the 20-somethings and what you do in that age because you have done so much less. And we want the way for us is to stay interested, to stay passionate, is to force ourselves into the same positions as we felt we were in when we were those 20-somethings. And with every year, and that's a bigger challenge every time, of course, because yes, I get more comfortable in the studio every time, and I'm even enjoying it now, and get more confident in my band's ability to be creative, to come up with things, to finish songs that we've started, you know, and all that. So we have to keep on trying that hard thing and find that what to us seems to be unknown territory. And that motivates how we evolve.
Well, I'll tell you what, you couldn't be more on the money, by the way, with the last two records. You know, are completely different. Two of my favorites from the last 5 years for sure. And like I said, I'm just kind of dipping into Hunter Gatherer right now, but I had to get it the first day it came out on vinyl because that's just how I roll. But the record's killer, man.
Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah, you're welcome. The record's killer. I can't wait to see you guys live again. Like I said, I think it's been about 3 years since I saw you live. And that was the first time. And I'm like, wow, these guys are awesome live. And it's just really great to catch up and talk with you. And hopefully when this whole thing passes, we'll see you around and about. So,
thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure. And just, you know, if we all make sure to wash our hands, not spit in each other's mouths, and those of us who are in a position to help those of us who are in need, we do that for a while and we make it through to the other side of this and the good times can return.
Johannes from Avatar today on Talkin' Rock with Meltdown. And yes, I highly recommend Hunter Gatherer. Welcome to Avatar Country. Really got me into the band. And this is just like kind of like extended it, but really good stuff from these guys. I got to thank my friend Jay Rustin. It seems like every band I talk to lately, he's producing, and he always gives me some good stuff to work with and some good stuff to ask the guys from the band. So really cool on that side as well. In the meantime, thank you so much for checking out the podcast, as we'll do it all over again real soon. I've got some cool interviews locked and loaded. Haven't done them yet, but I've got some locked and loaded, so check back often. And thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to Talkin' Rock with Meltdown. You can help this podcast grow by giving it a 5-star rating and writing a review on Apple and iTunes. Plus, feel free to subscribe and share it with your friends. Until next time, thanks for listening to Talkin' Rock.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking 5 of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on 5 we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top 5? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.